This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We are joining you from Aspen, Colorado, as part of the Aspen Ideas Festival. And while we're here, we decided we wanted to focus on the big ideas about education and, more broadly, learning. And if you missed your flight or lost your all-access pass, do not worry, because over the next 2 days, we'll be joined by many of the people who are shaking things up in education, or trying to. You can also join us online. Head to Twitter and use the hashtag NPRAspen. We'll be reading your tweets and sharing as many as we can over the next few days. Why are we talking about education? Well, one reason is that education has been critical to America's status as the land of opportunity, where anybody can rise and improve his or her circumstances through hard work, but also education. Later this hour, we want to ask a group of people who are all involved in education in one way or another whether that is still true. Is the U.S. still the land of opportunity for all, with education as the key? But we want to start with a newsmaker interview. John Daisy is the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District. That's the nation's second largest school system. He took the job there in April of 2011, and he's faced a number of the challenges that are seen in school systems across the country: budget cuts, fraught relationships between administrators, teachers, and parents, and, oh yes, the big one, teaching students effectively. And Superintendent John Daisy is with us now from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So let me just start with a simple question. What keeps you up at night?
Where do you want to begin? A great deal.
With the truth, that always helps.
Definitely. So I think one of the things that absolutely keeps me up at night is how quickly I can make good on the promise that we made to the hundreds of thousands of youth in Los Angeles that their rights would be honored and that they would all graduate college and workforce ready. We are a very large school system, and the overwhelming majority of the youth who I get the privilege of leading live in circumstances of peril and poverty. Many do not speak English at home. Many do not speak English as their first language. Many do not have access to health care. And every single one of those students wants to be you or I, and they want to graduate and enter post-secondary without remediation or enter the workforce and earn a living wage. And that is our promise, and we work at that at a very rapid pace, and I know that that causes stress for some others.
We talked about fraught relationships between teachers, parents, and kids, and balancing, you know, the needs, the interests, and the desires of all the various stakeholders, to use a word that we hear a lot in education. You know, when you're honest with yourself, what's the hardest relationship to maintain in a positive way?
At the moment, I think the hardest relationship to maintain in a positive way is the teachers' union leadership. And the administration. Membership are remarkable folks. I mean, I have seen the best teaching I've ever seen in my life in Los Angeles. I've seen people work in punishing economic circumstances, giving opportunity to students who otherwise just would not have that. But trying to move this system much quicker on a youth rights agenda has certainly been at times very prickly. And quite frankly, at times I just don't understand the opposition.
What do you mean you just don't understand it? Seems like, well, I mean, just to your point, back in April, 91% of the 17,000, almost 18,000 ballots cast by LA's teachers union expressed a vote of no confidence in your leadership. Back in April of 2012, there was a profile of you in the Los Angeles Times, and it described you as, quote, "Some see Daisy as a dynamic leader driven by a moral urgency to give all students a quality education. Others view him as a relentless taskmaster, intolerant of dissent." It's interesting to me that a number of school leaders have been described in very similar terms, like Michelle Rhee, for example, is a name that many people know, who was a leader for a time of the Washington, D.C. public school system. So why do you think that is?
So when the union orchestrated the vote, so about half of the membership voted, and that was their vote. During those days leading up to it, there was cartoons that were produced every day. The fact that we were feeding students in the classroom was a major reason why we should have no confidence.
Feeding breakfast to the students.
Right. So let's be really clear. We're not confused about our mission. And our mission is to serve students. And part of that mission is to ensure that students have a highly effective teacher in front of them every single day of the year in a school led by a highly effective principal. So we are very much driven by the issues of high instructional quality, by individuals who have the right to be in front of students, and we take that seriously. And the fact is that if folks are doing a phenomenal job, we should be doing everything to assure that they stay there. That goes way beyond their seniority number.
And if folks are not doing a phenomenal job, we should be intervening and trying to help them. And if they cannot get better, they don't have the right to be in front of students. So I get the stress around that. I get the fact that we've put in a new evaluation system. I understand the fact that we are moving technology as fast as any district I know around that. We are implementing the Common Core. But I have to be quite frank with you. If those things cause stress in adults, and I understand they do, then you need to come with me and visit the families who live in cars behind Huntington Park High School. You need to visit the young ladies who are having children, and we provide schools just for gals who are having babies because you don't drop out of school anymore, who see an OBGYN for the first time in the day they have their child. There's no access to health care. If we want to talk about stress, it's families with no parents. That's stress. I am convinced that we can get over adult stress to serve youth. You know, L.A. is a fascinating place. I say this all the time. L.A. is America only sooner. And we are coming to a hometown near you.
Or as we like to say, the way we live now.
Right. I mean, who we look like, our successes, our struggles. I mean, the economic viability of L.A. and California is intrinsically linked to the ability for this country to move forward. And that is going to depend on whether I can live up to the promise of getting every single student college and career ready.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Daisy. He's the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District. That's the nation's second largest school district. You can join our conversation using the hashtag NPRAspen. You know, I've been reviewing some of the comments and questions coming in via Twitter before you came today. And a lot of the questions, though, are about how you keep teachers inspired. I mean, a lot of the questions are about equity, and I think we're going to get to those on our next segment. Like, how do you make it more fair so that a student's, the quality of the education that a student receives is not dependent on his or her zip code? But a lot of the questions are, how do you keep interested, well-educated, exciting teachers in the classroom?
So there are thousands of those teachers in Los Angeles, and most days I am humbled when I visit schools. We visit schools every single day of the year, and that is part of our team's commitment. And I think the way that you keep amazing teachers is that you give them as much autonomy as possible, and that they have the ability to run their school as they see the most important way of doing that. So we have rapidly given schools the ability to lead themselves so that you have the notion of charter schools, and we're the largest charter authorizer in the United States. Regular traditional public schools should have the same degrees of freedom as charter schools, provided that they are getting the results. That has been a source of also stress inside of the labor unions as well. I remember I have 11 labor unions. I'm just focusing on one of them at the moment. But the idea that teachers positions in school should not be governed by seniority, but should be governed by how well they're doing their job there. Teachers want this. Teachers want to have autonomy over instruction. They want to have autonomy about who's teaching next to them. And we believe they should have that.
Tom, talk, if you would, for a couple of minutes about a decision not just by you, but also the school board had to agree to this and state legislatures as well, which is to give every child in the LA Unified School District an iPad.
We worked for a year, and when I began the most recent school year that just ended, I began the year by saying to students that we just simply won't have a digital divide any longer. As you pointed out, your zip code and the overwhelming majority of our youth do live in circumstances of poverty. That will not be a reason why you cannot have the same educational experience in Los Angeles as in Palo Alto or any other wealthier community. So we worked for a year and went through the process that we would, and we have made that decision, that every student will have, in this case, it will be an iPad and full digital content for the Common Core. And we're beginning just an extraordinary process of professional development and rethinking teaching and learning for students. And they will have all of that within the next 2 years.
I got a quick tweet here from Jason Thomas that I'd like to put to you. And he says, the government tries, but not every school fits the same mold. Communities must support, must invest. How do you assure that each school can meet the needs of the kids who are in that school?
It's a great question. For the last 2 years, I and many superintendents have been side by side with the governor as we have tried to rethink how you fund public education in California. And I would argue that the most historic change in public education has just taken place. So in the last 40 years, maybe since the Serrano court ruling, the greatest thing has just occurred, and that is how we're going to fund schools. And we're funding schools in a local control funding formula through a weighted student funding formula. Students with the greatest need will get the greatest amount of support. So it used to be an
equality-based funding formula. Everybody got the same equal amount. It's an equity-based funding formula. Those who have the least will continue to get greater support. And Los Angeles is a huge player in that, so that funding will come to schools now based on a base amount, and then there will be additional funding on concentration factors for groups of students who live in circumstances of poverty, don't speak English yet, or in foster care. And every other student who has that background will get even additional funding. That's a huge change.
So we're almost out of time. If you and I were to get together 5 years from now, hopefully in this beautiful place, what kind of conversation do you think we'll be having?
I think it'd be better if we got together 5 years from now in LA and you came to a high school graduation where every ninth grader who entered graduates. And that they are graduating and entering post-secondary, who are able to afford that, where they are not going bankrupt in student loans issues, and that we've had profound, robust immigration reform, so most of my parents are not living in shadows. That would be where we should be celebrating in 5 years.
Sign me up.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
John Daisy is the superintendent of Los Angeles Unified School District. That's the nation's second largest school district. We spoke with him from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Superintendent Daisy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My honor.
Thank you for coming. We are also hearing your thoughts about education on Twitter at hashtag NPR Aspen. I just want to read one more of the tweets that we got. It says, treat teacher time and energy as valuable, finite resources. Design schools to use them efficiently. That comes from Roxana Eldon in Miami. Please stay with us as we continue our special broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival. We're broadcasting from the Hotel Jerome. In a few minutes, we'll talk with a panel of educators, writers, and other doers about whether the U.S. is still the land of opportunity and what would make it so if it isn't. That's in just a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We hope you'll stay with us. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is our special broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival here in Aspen, Colorado. We're spending this hour talking about education and, more broadly, learning. Later in the program, we'll get the latest buzz from the guys who've made it out for a special Aspen barbershop. But first, we want to talk more about the question I asked John Daisy a few minutes ago. He's the superintendent of Los Angeles Unified School District, and we were talking about whether this is still the land of opportunity, where education offers that opportunity to everybody who wants it and is willing to work for it. Joining us now are Shirley Ann Jackson. She's president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She's a theoretical physicist. She also happens to be the first African-American woman to lead a top 50 research university. Joel Klein is a former chancellor of the New York City Department of Education. He's now the CEO of Amplify, the education division of News Corp. Madeline Levine is a psychologist and author of Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Paul Tuff is a writer who's been focusing on education for some time now. His latest book, How Children Succeed, is just out in paperback. Welcome to all of you. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me just start by asking the same question I asked Superintendent Daisy, and I'll start with Joel Klein. I'll start with you, because you also led a large, diverse school system with lots of kids, with lots of different challenges and backgrounds and opportunities. So is this still a land of opportunity where education is the key?
Certainly education is the key. The question is, will we deliver on that promise? You know, America created in the 20th century the greatest middle class in the history of the world by educating our people at an unprecedented rate. We were the first country to require that everybody go to secondary school. After the Second World War, we expanded college opportunities at unprecedented rates. I think the question which you're focusing on is exactly the right one, Michelle, which is now what we're seeing increasingly is a divide. Some kids are doing extremely well. More and more kids are falling behind. When John Daisy talks about college and career readiness, he's talking about exactly the right issue, which is, will we get our kids ready for what they will need in the 21st century. The world's a very different century. And right now, increasingly, what you see is less and less mobility. At the top colleges, you see fewer and fewer kids who grew up in poverty who are getting into those schools and those programs. You see fewer and fewer of those kids really climbing the economic ladder of opportunity. So I think we're focused on the right question. I think the next 10 years will answer that question for America, but shame on us if we get it wrong. Because America's got only one magic ingredient. It's called the American dream. Many of us have lived it. We want to make sure that future generations have that opportunity.
You know, to that end, I just remember that my colleague Renee Montaigne on Morning Edition spoke with the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, last week, and she asked him a similar question. I just want to play a short clip of what he had to say. Can we hear that clip? Okay, well, I'll read it to you. We're having a little technical difficulty here. He said that the civil rights issue of our time is this issue of the achievement gap. It's the democracy issue of our time. If you want an enlightened citizenry, they've got to be able to read and write. It's the economic issue of our time. If you want to be able to compete in the new economy, you have to have intellectual capital. So, Shirley Ann Jackson, let me ask you that question, because you're also interested in outcomes. I mean, you presumably are getting the best of the best.
We are. We get very bright students. I do believe this still is the land of opportunity, but it is that opportunity is becoming frayed. We sit where we get the product of the primarily the public school system, and there are issues with what we get, even for those who nominally are well-educated, who have high SAT scores, who have taken AP courses. And those things can range from how deep the knowledge is to what the maturity level of the young people turns out to be. And so we have to integrate across all of that. Now, I'm a scientist, and we educate primarily scientists and engineers. But I do believe that we have to be sure that we cover the basics, that the young person really does have to be able to read well, to articulate, to do basic math. Now, for students coming to us, they need more than that. I think we need to think about new compacts between higher education and secondary education. And what do I mean by that? We're one of the few really selective universities that really has an articulation agreement with a community college. Now, we specify what that curriculum should be. But if students succeed in that curriculum, and they do have to have pretty high grades, then we will have them come into the university. We do this because we realize that not all students are prepared leaving high school to come into a place like Rensselaer. And they aren't prepared sometimes because of academics, but interestingly enough, sometimes it's because of maturity and time management skills and so on. We also are beginning, and I spoke yesterday in a panel here in Aspen about MOOCs. We're looking at how we can use technology enablement to create better pathways for young people from secondary education into the university. So interestingly enough, even as we're developing technology-enabled courses that will be online, we're using our abilities to create pathways to strengthen the secondary skills, secondary education skills of students before they come.
Madeline Levine and Paul Tuff, I'm glad you're both here, because the thing that both of you have been writing about is whether we define success too narrowly now. So, Paul, why don't you start?
Sure. So I think that is part of the problem, that especially for the past decade or two, we've been focused very much in our school system, and I think in many of our families, on cognitive skills, on the sort of skills that get measured on standardized tests. And as Shirley Ann is pointing out, those matter a lot when kids get to college, but they're not all that matters. There's also this other set of skills that economists call non-cognitive skills, things like grit and perseverance, conscientiousness, optimism, that matter a lot, especially at the college level. And right now, I don't think we're doing a great job, either in schools or outside of schools, at developing those skills.
Why not?
Well, I think part of it has to do with education policy, that we've been so focused on standardized tests as the measure of whether a school is doing well, that we're not giving schools the time and the incentive to work on these other skills. But I think part of it goes to what's happening in families as well, that a lot of parents, especially affluent parents, are increasingly concerned about being able to measure how well their kids are doing. They feel like they're caught in this very competitive race. And without something that is easy to measure, like test scores, they don't know how well their kids are doing.
Madeline Levine, that's exactly what you talked about in your first book, and you also talk about in your second book. You're very concerned that kids who have everything, supposedly, everything in a material sense, devoted, interested parents, resources, are exhausted. Okay. And you are also a clinical psychologist, have all kinds of emotional problems. Talk a little bit about that and why you think that's a concern, not just for this small group of kids, but for other kids.
Well, it's a concern for all kids. First of all, the privileged kids that I wrote about first are, you know, sort of likely to go to schools like yours, to be in positions of authority as they grow up, policy decisions. We don't want them to be exhausted, cheating all the time. At Stanford, we just did a study, 95% of kids are cheating. It's well known. That's not who we want to be making policy for our country. I think the other thing
I
is
I think
that
I should have used the term ethically exhausted as well.
Right? Well, that's exactly right. And recently I had a little 8-year-old boy in my office, and he's sitting on the couch, and when I ask him what he wants to do, what he likes to do, and what he wants to be when he grows up, he tells me he wants to be a venture capitalist. Now, his feet don't even hit the floor. And while it's funny because venture capital, you know, whatever, and maybe he will be a venture capitalist, but not at 8, because at 8 he has a whole bunch of other developmental tasks that he has to master. When you're talking about maturity, I see it as coping skills. Julie Lithcott-Hames, who is the dean of freshmen at Stanford, loves the story of the young girl who gets to Stanford, gets a little confused the first day, doesn't know where her next class is, and instead of reaching into her backpack to find the schedule, calls her mother 16 time zones away. That's a lack of coping skills, and it's a tiny, you know, I like it because it's a small example. It's not a great big example. But you add that kind of limited coping skill up, and it doesn't really matter where you've gone to school. You're not collaborative. You don't know how to work. You're not self-reliant, all the things that you write about, Paul. So I think that's a big issue as well. This narrow definition of success stresses our most academically talented kids in very dangerous ways, and I think marginalizes a whole bunch of other kids who have talents in other areas.
It's interesting because I'm looking at the Twitter questions and comments coming in. I mean, hundreds of people are joining us from Louisiana, New Jersey, North Carolina, New Jersey, and they seem to fall into two groups. I mean, one is like Valerie Burton, who's a teacher in New Orleans, says, yes, this will always be the land of opportunity. We just must refine how to give these opportunities to all. And then there are people who are articulating some of the issues that we're talking about here, which is why is success defined so narrowly? It's doing really well on the test. You know, the test, and then getting into this school or that school. And so what I'm wondering here is, how do you reconcile the fact that some kids clearly aren't getting what they need now, and yet there are a lot of people who are concerned that the kids who are getting everything they supposedly need, that somehow something's not working? Joel Klein?
Well, look, I think the points that Madeline and Paul are making are very important points, but I don't think either one of them would say that we should forget about teaching our kids to read or teaching our kids to write or do the higher order thinking. Somehow we've got to figure out a way to get the whole package. And the problem you're talking about is if you define success narrowly, we're not remotely meeting that narrow definition. Now, Paul and Madeline are saying we've got to broaden the definition, which I totally agree with. But that's going to mean we're going to have more time in school for our kids. We're going to have to, which could contribute to stress, unfortunately. But you got to do the kinds of things that Shirley needs, because otherwise we're kidding ourselves. To send these kids to her, and she's got a great school. There are a lot of other schools we send them to, and they're still not remotely prepared to do the work. And as Paul has pointed out, they don't have the grit, the determination, the stick-to-itiveness to grow. So it seems to me what we're trying to do is both widen the definition, but make sure we meet that widened definition, and that's going to put increasing challenges on the public school system.
Well, let's talk, though, in the time that we have left, and we have about 5 minutes left, which is clearly not enough time, but let's start with what would fix this thing? Let's fix this thing right now. And I also do, but I think a lot of parents wonder about the idea of keeping kids in school longer in schools that aren't working now. And I think they wonder what that accomplishes. I'll just throw that out there. Paul, let's fix this thing.
So I would say, I'm not sure I've got all the fixes, but I would say that part of the answer is to that we need to go beyond school. So what Joel Klein has done, what John Dacey is doing right now in school systems, is giving more advantage to lots, more opportunity to lots of kids, especially those who wouldn't have that kind of opportunity otherwise. But I think schools alone are not enough to take on the kind of disadvantages that kids are growing up with, especially kids who are growing up in poverty and disadvantage. So I think we need to do more work as a society in the early years, figure out ways to support families, especially struggling families in the first few years of a child's life. And I think we need to do more work on the way to college as well and engage more colleges to be better partners with kids, first-generation college students, who need more help at that stage.
Shirley-Ann Jackson, do you want to talk more about that?
I'd say two things. I think we need a more integrative approach to education that recognizes that a person is a whole person, that there are these cognitive skills and abilities that need to be developed, but they can be developed in contexts that can help with these other elements of what a person really is. And it also would help to delineate where people's skills and intelligences really are, and there are multiple intelligences.
So what does that mean? Do you change the school day? Do you do more social learning during the day? You know, social learning means how to get along, how to be a better person, character building.
Let me give you an example.
Tell me what to do.
I once taught a little class in grade school, and the kids were learning about John Glenn, you know, the senator and former astronaut. And so they were talking about him going into Earth orbit for the first time. But then they separately go somewhere else, and maybe they try to teach kids about escape velocity, meaning how you get out of the gravitational pull of the Earth. Well, why couldn't you do a complete story about John Glenn the man, weave in what some of the science is, and talk about the historical significance all at once, and then have the young people try things, because they have a lot of energy, and so that they can get a sense of what escape velocity is. It can be as simple as trying to throw paper clips up into the air and see what happens. And so these are things that what I mean by the integrative, because kids have a lot of energy. And here's the thing. We have college students. They have a lot of energy. And so we have an approach that we call clustered learning advocacy and support for students. And we cover the whole spectrum in terms of what goes into their heads, their hearts, and their bodies.
Madeline Levine.
I think we need socio-emotional learning in every classroom. Chicago's doing a good job of integrating it, which means that not as a separate course, but as part of how everything is taught. And I also think every one of us, when you said you get the best of the best, I think we need to think differently. She gets a particular kind of good student.
But you don't know what I mean.
Okay. Joel Klein?
Three quick things. One, let's give families more choices. Everybody wants more choices when it comes to education. Second of all, let's make teaching the most respected, most revered profession in America. We really have not done that right. And third, for the first time, let's really use technology to empower our teachers, change the learning process. Shirley was talking about MOOCs. We've had a lot of things here at Aspen about how to use technology. You're sitting there reading Twitter quotes and stuff. Every place but education has gone through a technological revolution, and education is sitting still. And I think the opportunities to empower our teachers, change the learning process, engage kids. I've seen it with the work we're doing at Amplify, and I've been in schools that are using these products and how excited they are. You want to get kids working together? Give them the kind of quest we put them on. Figure out in groups who killed Edgar Allan Poe and why. Those are the kinds of experience that I think technology can unleash, and we'll get it done.
I'm going to ask you the last question, because you are a person who's operated kind of in the political realm. Do we have the will as a country to do these things that we've talked about here? Do we care enough to do it?
I think we have to have the will. See, I am of the view, people don't become a school chancellor unless you're an eternal optimist. And I am of the view that what Shirley Ann said before is exactly right. America is unique in being a land of opportunity. John Dacey talked about immigrants coming from all over the world to be part of the American dream. If we don't give them the kinds of things that the people on this panel are talking about to get them where they need to go, then the American dream becomes the American memory on our watch, and that's intolerable. So the answer to your question is we need the political will. Right now, political will seems in short supply in our nation's capital, but we need to get there.
You can still join our conversation. Go to hashtag TMM Aspen, hashtag NPR Aspen. Thank you all so much for joining us. Joel Klein is a former chancellor of New York City Schools. He's now CEO of Amplify. That's the education division of News Corp. Also with us, Shirley Ann Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Madeline Levine is a clinical psychologist and author of Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Paul Tuff's latest book, How Children Succeed, is just out in paperback. I thank you all so much for joining us from the Aspen Ideas Festival, this special broadcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for a visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. We're here in Aspen for the Aspen Ideas Festival, and we couldn't get into the shop, so we brought the shop to us. Mm-hmm. I'm joined by culture critic Jimmy Israel. Steve Inskeep is with us, in for the first time, host of NPR's Morning Edition. Joining us, Anand Giridharadas, columnist for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome, both of you in for the first time. Welcome to the shop.
Absolutely. We thought we were actually going to get our hair cut here, so we're...
Well, dude, I love it. I've got my hair cut. Aspen is really the home of the $50 haircut. We can get a nice little foot massage and a nice little dainty cup of espresso, so I appreciate that.
Okay, I'm waiting for the espresso. That'll be good.
You'll be waiting, brother.
All right.
So, you know, let's get things started. We're going to talk about some big ideas out here in Aspen, and we've been talking a lot about whether the U.S. is still the land of opportunity for everyone.
I'm interested in what you have to say, Jimmy, in part because you are a teacher as well. You're a college professor as well, and you see a lot of kids coming in front of you, and I'm wondering what you've been seeing over the
years. Well, before I was all that, I was a father. And what troubles me the most is this morning we know that student loans, they doubled. They doubled, and I got like four kids. Are you serious? And so to me, opportunity, you can get about as much opportunity in America as you can afford, I believe. You know, I think also education is changing. The value of education is changing. And we're paying too much, I believe, for too little. And the bones of the public education space are rotting, and we need some better ideas.
Let's keep this in perspective.
All right, Steve,
though.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I travel a lot for work to fascinating places. I mean, Venezuela, Colombia, Iran, Iraq,
Cleveland.
I've been to Cleveland, New Orleans, Detroit, places like that. When you go overseas. Everywhere you go overseas, you will encounter someone who tells you the story of how they tried to get a visa to the United States. America is the land of opportunity. People overseas understand that. People in troubled countries especially understand that. But I will agree with what you're saying to the extent that is it the land of equal opportunity? And that's still a problem. I went to Morehead State University in Kentucky, which is in the eastern part of the state, in the coal mining region. And they have this ceremony at graduation. They say everybody who's the first person in your family ever to graduate from college, stand up. Half the graduating class stands up year after year after year after year. And some of the professors even find that a little depressing because they feel like we've been at this for decades. We really should have, you know, we should be having second generation and third generation students by now.
Amazing.
It's an incredibly slow process.
I was raising my hand on that question.
I think Steve's right, but I think part of what really distresses me, again, with that same perspective of other countries in here, is that there's this very weird reversal and inversion happening between America and the developing world. If you go to places like India, like China, like Brazil, and you ask them, why were you not succeeding for your people until very recently? The answer they will give you is, we were a society that existed for very few people at the top and then catered through subsidies and handouts to a lot of people at the bottom, and we never invested in the middle. And the reason India and China and Brazil are finally waking up, and you're hearing about these countries, is that they have become middle-centric societies, obsessed with cultivating their middle. And in the very same time that they've done that, I think we have gone the other way. And we've become an Aspen society at one end, and then you drive 2 hours in any direction from where we are right now, and the family is falling apart, schools are not great, people are losing their sense that there's a reasonable relationship between effort and reward.
You know, I think
definitely. I would give to that ambition and hard work isn't enough in America anymore. You need a little luck to succeed here. Go ahead, Steve.
I think that's totally fair, and that's something I think about a lot. The people that graduated from Morehead State University in Kentucky, I mean, those are people who managed, often with great personal struggle, to get through to a college degree, and many of them may still be a million miles from being at the top, or a million miles from even seeing the top. And there's so many reasons for that. One of them was mentioned earlier, though, which is just the sense of understanding how to cope and understanding that you can get someplace. I heard Anand talk last night in front of a fireplace. Michelle had a conversation with him, and you were talking about people in India who feel that they are supposed to be at the bottom, feel that they have internalized the idea that they are to be at the bottom. You felt that is changing. In India, finally, it's beginning to change. I think there are a lot of people in America that struggle to realize how far they can climb, and that is part of the problem, is understanding that you can grab the opportunities that are there, that they can be there for you if you can just find them.
I just want to jump in for a minute, and if you're just joining us, we're having a special edition of our barbershop roundtable. We usually have this conversation on Friday, but we're all here in Aspen, so we're having it today. We're joined by culture critic Jimmy Israel. NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep decided he needed a trim, and we all agreed, so here he is. And columnist Anand Giridharadas.
I'm hoping to shave is part of this also, because, you know.
We can arrange that.
Anand Giridharadas is with us.
He was
straight
actually
razor.
The first.
How are you with the straight razor? Anyway,
He was the first Bombay to open a bureau in Bombay for the New York Times back in 2005, and has a very interesting sort of story himself. Our colleagues who cover education at NPR pointed us to the Program for International Student Assessment. Steve, you were making the point of not even necessarily knowing where you stack up in the world. Mm-hmm. It measures how some of the more developed countries in the world stack up when it comes to education, and some so-called developing countries participated as well. The most recent numbers said that U.S. 15-year-olds were pretty much average in that group when it comes to reading literacy, but U.S. students were below average in math literacy and average in science. I'm very interested in this question because, Anand, to your point, and it's not that fewer kids in the U.S. are going to school, but the question is, are our schools as effective? Are American students able to compete? Or is it still that internationally only a very few kids actually get to compete in other parts of the world?
The difficult thing about the education statistics is they're very complicated to understand and parse. So let me give you a simpler statistic that's kind of an outcome statistic. The OECD, richest countries in the world, I think 19 or 20 of these countries, there's a study on in which of these countries can your parents' income be used to predict the child's income, right? That's not an index you want to win, because that means rich people's dumb kids stay rich and poor people's brilliant kids stay poor. Mm-hmm. We are number one in the U.S. in that index. Mm. That's not the kind of index you want to lead. So then you can argue about whether it's the schools or the family or welfare or hip-hop lyrics. It doesn't matter what your set of causes
are. It is totally the opposite of our image of ourselves.
Everything's
hip-hop's
fault. Yeah. Everything's hip-hop's fault.
I thought it was Twitter. I thought you said it was Twitter's
fault. It's
the
Twitter. But I...
What if you tweet hip-hop lyrics?
But we're still encouraging you if you want to join our conversation via Twitter. So even if we are ruining the world as we know it, we're still encouraging you to join us via hashtag NPR Aspen. I have a tweet from a listener named Bill who asks the group, what do you believe is the root cause of public education in the U.S. not keeping pace with that of other countries? Yes, I did add a preposition. Thank you very much. I know that's not the Twitter Twitter norm, but yes, I added a preposition.
You know, grammar and stuff.
I'm troubled that we often map education and credentials to your almost guaranteed success in America. I mean, I call that the Cosby formula, that if you go to college, you will be rich. And I think that's a problem. I teach my children that, you know, to go to school, get that paper, also be about your passion, you know, and your passion should lead to a career that becomes your life work. Don't go and become a biomed major and get and go off into that and you don't love it, and then you find out that the world, the marketplace is crowded with biomedical majors, also with lawyers. We got too many lawyers because people are they believe that that degree will lead to a life of milk and honey, and that isn't true anymore. I have PhD friends, I have MFA friends that work at Starbucks. They're not even managers, they're not even key holders. You know, so
but they make really amazing lattes.
Awesome lattes.
And
go ahead, Steve. You want a piece of this?
Well, yeah, totally. I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. I mean, I think there are too many people that think of education as going for a specific career, which is exactly what you're talking about. And the world is changing too fast. And if I think about my own experience, what I would suggest to people is to think of education as building life skills and ways to grasp the broader world. The great gap in my education was I didn't do very much language, didn't do very many language classes. I took Latin. And when I graduated, I discovered that Latin is relatively little spoken in the world today. And I've spent the rest of my adult life catching up and learning Spanish and learning Arabic and trying to learn fragments of other languages. And when I go overseas, I encounter the exact opposite. Every poor neighborhood you go into will have storefront English schools. There'll be a sign, it'll say English primary school. Primary will be misspelled, but people are grabbing the global economy, and they want to understand the broader world in a way that many of us do.
But is that for self-improvement, or is that because they feel that that's their ticket to the milk and honey? English is now the global language.
It is definitely both.
So can you really fault people when people are going into debt of, you know, we hear stories about kids not just leaving college and grad school with five-figure debt loads, but six-figure debt loads, because they have been told that this is what they need to do to compete in the world. Can you really tell them that they're wrong?
Well, I mean, we can talk about education expense and whether you really get your money's worth at a private college. We could have that discussion. But let me suggest this. If you're going to have a $50,000 or $60,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 student debt, you'd better have learned something that's going to benefit you for 40 years and not be prepared for a specific job at age 23 that may not even exist by the time you graduate.
Amen.
Anna, quickly.
Let me also just introduce something to this that, you know, I think like the rest of us on this stage have chosen to do what we've done through the route of education. But and we have great educators on this panel before us, but I think it's also interesting to think about if in the meantime we're not going to be able to educate everybody terrifically. I think we also need to be a country where people can do great things and create opportunity for themselves without having had that opportunity. We didn't have great education when the country was founded and a lot of the country was built for most people, but we still managed to build a great country. And so if we are in an austere time, if we are in a time when schools are failing, let's fix them. But in the meanwhile, I think we need to teach people hustle and legal hustle and buying things here and selling them there for a higher price. And be real about where our economy is and what opportunities we can provide while we're trying to fix everything.
Well, as we said, this is the Ideas Festival. And remember, we started the program by asking John Daisy, the superintendent of the LA Unified School District, what keeps him up at night. So I actually want to close today with the other question, which is what gets you all up in the morning, other than that latte?
Okay.
So,
all right, let me just say.
Hopefully it's a big idea.
My parents were public school teachers. They're both retired now. And I feel that what I do every day is an extension of what they do. I get up in the morning, I try to learn about the world, learn something, and pass it on to other people. I think that's a great thing to do when I can manage it. I think it's a great thing for citizens to do, whether they are writers or journalists or doing something else in life.
Hmm. Anna?
I think for me, in a lot of my writing, I write about clashes of perspectives on an issue like education or any other political issue. And for me, what gets me up is trying to show people that there are common values underneath those divides. And people actually do care about the same things if you scrape deep enough. And I hope we can start to have at least adolescent, if not adult, political conversations in this country.
And for me, with my students, I try to encourage them to be curiosity, to be curious, and to freely express themselves. With my children, I try to keep them curious in the age of Google and also encourage common knowledge, a return to common knowledge.
Hmm. We have a couple more minutes, actually, so you can expand on that thought. When does that ever happen? We have a couple more minutes to talk about this.
Oh. This is the moment of the segment where we actually start to cut each other's hair.
well, Michelle, what about you?
I volunteer.
You? Michelle, what about you?
I'm not used to being on this end of the... of the equation. What do you want to know? What keeps me up at night or what gets me up in the morning?
What gets you up in the morning?
Well, I'll answer both questions. What keeps me up at night is the same thing that keeps a lot of people up at night, which is that the kids that I see out here, the kids who increasingly look like the country that is becoming, not the country that was, are they getting what they need? And what they need is sometimes very different from what people think that they need, you know, or what people 25 years ago needed. Their relationship to authority, their understanding of themselves, the need to see themselves in the story of America sometimes is very much missing. But what gets me up in the morning is very much, I think, the same thing that gets all of you up in the morning is the power of words. We believe in the power of words. We believe that words matter. We believe that ideas matter. We believe that we can change things with goodwill, with passion, with energy, with the desire to make things better, not just for ourselves, not just for our families, not just for our own sort of personal universe, but for other people, the kid we're never going to meet, you know, touching the future, you know, that kind of thing. So did you all hear a big idea? We've been focusing on education. Is there a big idea in education that you all heard that you would like to talk about? I know you're not in the should business, Steve. I'm not in the should business.
I was listening to Joel Klein yesterday talk about getting technology into schools, and I tweeted about it, and there was a phenomenal response, a lot of it negative. This is a really tense topic for a lot of people. You know, if we're spending money on technology in schools, is it being done in a, you know, a proper way? Is it being done to just cause a profit for a company? Is it being done to displace teachers? At the same time, the opportunities seem huge and they seem really exciting. And one of the most exciting ideas that I heard in that discussion was the notion of kids who are all on tablets, but the teacher is monitoring what they do on the tablet, which makes it easier for the teacher to understand what the kid specifically is learning and absorbing and what the kid is kind of skating past and not quite getting. And that notion of paying attention to the individual, I think, is huge.
It also makes it easier for the
Angry Bird or Cut the Rope. Hopefully it's not Angry Birds or Cut the Rope, even though the people who invented that might be sitting right here. I don't know. Sorry, if you are.
And just listening to all the education practitioners before us, I think we have, it's almost impossible for us in this country to have arguments, meaningful arguments about equality, because there's just such divided sides, and this country is a very divided heritage. I think the big takeaway for me is, let's set aside the conversation about adult equality, where we'll never agree. I think we can probably have an 80% consensus on children's equality. No one chooses to be a poor kid. We can all agree on that.
Let's leave it there for now. That's Anand Giridharadas. He's a columnist for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. He's the author of India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Steve Inskeep is with us. We hope you'll come back and see us. You have
All
to
right.
stay up a little bit later, but NPR's Morning Edition, host of NPR's Morning Edition, co-host, I should say. He's the author of Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Jimmy Israel is a writer and culture critic, adjunct professor of film and social media at Cuyahoga Community College. He's the author of The Denzel Principle. They were all here in Colorado at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yep.
Remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. We are still having our conversation online at hashtag NPR Aspen. We're still asking you to join the conversation. We want to know what keeps you up at night when it comes to education. We'd like to know how you think technology should be brought into the classroom. Join the conversation at hashtag NPR Aspen. We'll hear more from you live on the air tomorrow. That's our program for today. We'd like to thank all of our guests who joined us here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Please join us again tomorrow as we continue our broadcast from here. Remember that on Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. Use hashtag NPR Aspen on Twitter to keep telling us about the education ideas that matter to you. And before we go, we must welcome three new member stations who are joining the Tell Me More family. We're now being carried on KPCC in Pasadena, California, Lakeshore Public Media in Northwest Indiana, and on Hawaii Public Radio. Aloha. I'm Michelle Martin. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.